Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on air. On tonight's program, we get an overview of what you should know about high blood pressure.
What problems happen when blood pressure is not well controlled, like heart problems, strokes, kidney failure. So that is why high blood pressure is very important to treat.
Plus, what is Legionnaire's disease, and should you be worried about it?
About 2% of all pneumonias that are caught in the community, Legionnaire's pneumonia or Legionnaire's disease.
And how much does when you eat affect your weight gain or loss?
They took mice who had been in the study who had no time frame, put them back into a time frame, and they actually lost weight.
We'll get a checkup from the neck up and hear from our healing muse. That's all coming up right after the news. Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we take a look at what exactly is Legionnaire's disease and are you at risk for it? Plus, does when you eat have a greater impact on your health than what you eat? But first, all about hypertension and what you can do about it. More than 67 million American adults have high blood pressure, and only about half of them have their condition under control. We'll hear with more on this and what we can do about it is Dr. Apoorv Khanna, Associate Professor of Medicine at Upstate Medical University and the Upstate Medical University Complex Hypertension Program Director. Welcome, Dr. Khanna. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Linda.
So high blood pressure or hypertension is a real problem with real medical consequences. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. And in fact, you mentioned in your introduction that there are around 67 million Americans with high blood pressure. In fact, the last estimate is that this number may be higher even than 75 million. And as you said, around approximately half or a little more of these patients don't have their blood pressure well controlled. And they and overall, you know, society then goes on to see what problems happen when blood pressure is not well controlled, like heart problems, strokes, kidney failure. So that is why high blood pressure is very important to treat.
And is it that most people are unaware of the problem, or are they just unwilling to perhaps do the necessary steps that are
involved? Think it is a combination perhaps of both. In the sense that unless high blood pressure has already caused damage to the heart, to the kidney, caused a stroke, there is no real way for somebody to tell if they have high blood pressure. So that's one. Second is that obviously this is a condition which needs treatment in most patients for their entire lifetime from when they're diagnosed. And, you know, I would say, even for myself, I would say, you know, if I have to follow an exercise regimen, follow a treatment plan for the rest of my life, that's a difficult thing to do. And then I think also there are maybe some other causes which are causing the blood pressure not to be well controlled, which people may not be aware of, and hopefully we can help them.
Just help us understand, when we say hypertension or high blood pressure, what exactly is happening in the body?
So what high blood pressure or hypertension is that we measure, and you probably a lot of our listeners have had their blood pressure checked. So what that does is that we are checking essentially the pressure with which blood is being pushed through the circulation. And when we measure this, there will be two numbers that we measure. One, which is the top number, also called the systolic, and the bottom number, which is called the diastolic. And if we see that, and this is very important, if we see that on a consistent basis, the top number is over 140, or the bottom number is over 90, then we say that somebody has high blood pressure or hypertension.
And is it because the heart is doing this, or some kind of stoppage or closing down of the circulatory system?
So a lot of it is, the main thing I would say is that there is, as people get older, there is stiffening of the blood vessels, of the circulation. So as the blood vessels become less elastic, blood pressure or the pressure in the circulation tends to go up.
So it doesn't necessarily reflect a problem with the heart at that point.
No, I would say that more so than looking as the heart as the cause, I think high blood pressure has some very important consequences for the heart.
So who, you mentioned people as they get older, generally who's most at risk for this? Does it run in families, for example, or is it, how would you even know that you might be someone who could be at risk for high blood pressure?
Absolutely. So it certainly runs in families, but the other thing I would like to point out is that pretty much anyone over the age of 60, 65 is at risk and goes on to develop high blood pressure. But there are certain groups in the population who are more predisposed to having high blood pressure, such as African Americans, Hispanic Americans, Native Americans, and then obviously people who are overweight, and people who may be more sedentary, who are not exercising or unable to exercise regularly. And then, of course, it's related to the diet, too.
Have we seen an increase in hypertension in this country?
Yes. And I would, what we also know is that high blood pressure or hypertension is the most common diagnosis overall with which people go and are seen within the healthcare system. And we have also seen that recently people are there are more and more visits to the emergency room to get treatment for this condition.
So it's not something they may have known all along they have, but some kind of a crisis, maybe a massive headache or some kind of pain, will bring them to the emergency room, and then they discover that they are suffering from high blood pressure.
Yes, so it could be that when the blood pressure is very high, people could have chest pain, or they could have a very severe headache. They may notice that there is some blurring of their vision, and those would be things that would bring people in.
Why do you think it's gone up in this country? Does it have to do with the increase in obesity in this country and factors like that?
I think that is most likely what is, the most important cause. That is, as people are gaining weight and overall as a country, obesity is rising in America. That would be one cause. And then I think additionally, people are becoming, well, a lot of people do exercise regularly, but there are people who are getting to be very sedentary. And it's also related to diet, to the use of fast food, use of canned food. Those kind of things will also lead to an increase.
I want to talk more about that kind of thing in just a minute. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Apoorv Khanna, and we're talking about hypertension, its dangers, and what can be done about it. So if people come to an emergency room in a crisis, while they can care for you at that moment in time and perhaps avert some more serious event, that's not really sufficient when it comes to treatment over time. Explain that.
Yes. So what needs to be understood that when we're treating high blood pressure in the emergency room, in fact, that I would say applies to any medical condition. At that point, the goal of treatment is just to make the patient stable. It's not so much at that point to go into the cause and to control it over a long period of time. So I think high blood pressure can really only be managed by regular office visits to the patient's doctor.
Hence what you said before, there needs to be a commitment to seeing a health professional on a regular basis, to checking your blood pressure. If there's any suspicion that you might have this or if you've been diagnosed with it, it's important that it be monitored in a regular way. And then tell us about the kinds of treatments. What are the kinds of, is medication mostly the source of treatment or dietary? You've been alluding to that. Tell us about
that. Yes. So when we say high blood pressure is a number, the top number over 140 and a bottom over 90, there are those patients in whom diet and exercise just by itself can help if followed by the patient. And those would be individuals who have relatively mild hypertension. By that, we mean in patients in whom the top number is under 160 and the bottom number is under 100. Now, if we see somebody whose numbers are higher than that, I wouldn't say that diet and exercise is not important. It is very important. But what we know is that these patients will need medications in addition to all these lifestyle changes to control blood pressure.
So the key is to know your numbers, obviously, to be checked on a regular basis, and if necessary, take your medication. How about the dietary issues? How important is salt or your salt intake?
So salt, I would say, is the most important factor in our diet. Now,
in terms of making your blood pressure worse.
Yes. So the more the salt in the diet, the more likely you are to have high blood pressure. Now, we would have all, you know, maybe heard it on the radio, seen it on TV, a mention of a low salt diet, and at places it will say less than 2 grams of sodium. But I think sometimes that's difficult for people to understand how much does that mean. So what I would, the best estimate of that is that the amount of salt that a person eats in one day in all their foods and table salt and however should not be more than 1 teaspoon of salt.
Wow.
So that is approximately what we would say is the upper limit. And on an average, Americans consume maybe 2 to 3 times as much salt.
Yes. But with hypertension, that's really important. And that's a good visual to think of a teaspoon of salt.
Yes.
But I think there's a lot of hidden salt that people don't realize. I mean, it was striking to me recently when someone pointed out that just a simple loaf of bread or slices of bread when you go to a restaurant have an enormous amount of salt, but you don't even taste it.
Yes. So the obviously, when people eat out, there is, you know, it's very difficult to control the salt in their food. So as you said, things like bread will have salt, but also there are things like, and as I said, high blood pressure is found more so in as people get older. And those may be the people who are more dependent on prepared foods, who may be eating more canned food, more soup. So as people get older and for these reasons start using prepared food, their salt intake also goes up.
So it really has to be monitored. And
Absolutely.
That's where important contact with a health professional and perhaps even a dietitian
Yes.
plays a very important role. I don't want to run out of time. There are some people who is very hard to control their blood pressure. You have a whole clinic and a department that takes a look at that. What seems to help those people?
So what we have to understand is that there are some things in the diet. There could be over-the-counter pain medications, which could be increasing somebody's blood pressure. Somebody may be regularly using decongestants. People, because of being overweight, may have sleep apnea, which is a cause of difficult to control high blood pressure. And then we can help them in finding out if somebody has underlying kidney disease, has underlying hormonal issues, which are the two most common causes of difficult to control high blood pressure, which can really only be found by investigation from a doctor, not so much that people can manage in their diet.
So in a sense, your specialty area in the specialty clinic serves those people who really have trouble controlling their high blood pressure.
Yes. So we see patients who are, say, what we say resistant high blood pressure or are on three or more medications. And when their blood pressure is still not controlled, they are referred to us by their family doctors, by the heart doctors, by the kidney specialist, and we help them in controlling it.
Well, I want to thank you. That was very, very helpful, a very nice overview of the whole problem. And let's hope our listeners will take that advice in terms of getting in touch with their own physicians, keeping in touch and track of their numbers and their diet and exercise as well. Thanks so much for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Apoorv Khanna. He's Associate Professor of Medicine and the Director of the Complex Hypertension Program at Upstate Medical University. Next up, Legionnaire's disease. What is it, and are you at risk? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air, Linda Cohen joining you. Legionnaire's disease. It's a rather deadly form of pneumonia, and with the recent increase of cases in the Bronx in New York City, health officials are warning New Yorkers to be on the lookout for this disease. We'll hear with more on this is Dr. Robert Lennox, Professor of Medicine Emeritus and the past chief of the Division of Pulmonary Critical Care at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Lennox. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
So, 11 cases I have here of the disease were reported in the Bronx in December of 2014, and that was compared to only 2 in December of 2013 and only 3 in December of 2012. That seems to be like almost a 300% increase in the number of cases. Tell me about that. I mean, does it pose any threat to us, for example, here in Central New York, to see this boost, this bump in cases? Okay.
So it probably represents no threat to us compared to our underlying risk for this disease. About 2% of all pneumonias that are caught in the community are Legionnaire's pneumonia or Legionnaire's disease. And of those who get admitted to the hospital with serious illness, it represents a higher percentage than that. So we always have to keep it in mind.
So that's the point. I mean, let's start out. I think it'd be helpful to try to define what we mean when we say Legionnaire's disease. What is it exactly, and how do we get it?
Okay. It's a bacteria, and it commonly lives in water. So any water source can lead to infection with this. So the history of the disease is it started in it was identified in 1976, and it occurred at American Legion convention in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and there was a air conditioning unit that the water from the air conditioning condensing was infected with Legionella and spread it through the air conditioning. So many of the American Legion attendees at that meeting came down with a very serious pneumonia.
I read that 221 people got sick and 34 of them died, so yes, that's a pretty high percentage.
Yeah. And at that time, we didn't know of the existence of the organism. That outbreak led to the identification of the organism.
And the naming of it, in fact, right?
Yes.
Because we call it Legionnaire's disease after that occurrence, and the name of the bacterium is called Legionella.
That's correct.
So that's pretty profound.
Yes.
But you yourself have had some personal experience with that back in 1976.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
I was an intern in 1976, and the index case, the first person to come down with pneumonia, went to the convention and then returned to the hospital I was doing my internship at and became very seriously ill with pneumonia. We treated them with what we considered broad-spectrum antibiotics, but as it turns out, they weren't the right antibiotics, and the patient went on and died very quickly, very rapid downhill course, with bilateral serious pneumonia and eventually respiratory failure and death. We didn't know there was an epidemic at that time, but fortunately, the attending physician wanted very much to get an autopsy, and the family agreed to it. And that patient, as long as we're available, to the CDC. The next day, another small hospital in Pennsylvania had three cases. So they all came back from the same
convention,
so that they knew that there was something connected to that convention that led the CDC to investigate. And then the CDC had the lungs from the autopsy on the patient who died in our hospital. And they were able to identify the organism, which had not been identified before, but had been felt to cause outbreaks in the past.
Yeah, I was asking you about that actually before we started our conversation. You said that there was some disease called Pontiac?
There was an outbreak of pneumonia and fever in Pontiac, Michigan. They never found the organism, but they went back after Legionella was identified, and there were antibodies to that organism in the people who had that fever.
The fact was, this so-called Legionnaire's disease pre-existed this 1976 outbreak, but they had no way of naming it or understanding it fully.
Yes,
and so
correct.
When it broke out in 76, your case
helped the CDC
define
figure
it
out. Yes.
And identify it. And in fact, it became named, as we said, for that particular outbreak. So help us again. How dangerous is it? I mean, what's the fatality rate?
The fatality rate is higher than most bacterial pneumonias, but with proper treatment, which we know what to treat with now, the chances of dying are much less, particularly if the treatment is started early. Because of the seriousness of the illness, the recommendations for empiric therapy, that is therapy without knowing what the organism is that's causing pneumonia, for community-acquired pneumonia, that is pneumonia acquired outside of the hospital or healthcare setting, the recommendations include an antibiotic that will cover Legionella and several other bacteria that we normally don't think of when we think of community-acquired pneumonia.
So in other words, the approach these days is to do a broad-spectrum antibiotic, including what would kill Legionella.
Yes, until we get the
until
culture.
You know otherwise.
Yes.
So you don't even wait to try to figure out the
That's
bug.
Right.
You kind of just cover yourself.
You try to get cultures and start the antibiotic as soon as possible.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with pulmonologist Dr. Robert Lennox. We're talking about Legionnaire's disease. So just remind us again how it's contracted. You literally are exposed to water drops, water vapor. How does that happen?
If the water gets aerosolized and you inhale it,
like
it's
in steam,
your lungs,
for example?
Well, steam may be too hot and may kill the organism, but hot water will not, and chlorine doesn't do that good of a job of killing the organism. So it lives in the water supply. So if you take a shower and it's aerosolized, the water, you can inhale it and catch the infection, or as the original infection or outbreak was from an air conditioning duct. Or air conditioning system. So there are ways that any way that water gets aerosolized can lead to you inhaling the organism.
So it's not contractable person to person.
No,
it's not coughing or sneezing. It's not airborne in that sense.
No,
from person to person.
It's not like the measles or tuberculosis, which is airborne. This is spread by the water, by water being aerosolized and then inhaling it. It It also has a tendency to infect those whose immune system is not as strong as a normal person. So if somebody has diabetes or they have cancer and they're on chemotherapy, they are much more at risk than people who do not have those underlying immune deficiencies.
So what exactly do you see? What are the symptoms? I mean, how do you know that you're getting it?
So it starts out much like influenza. So you get body aches, fever, muscle aches, you may get diarrhea. And then about 2 or 3 days into it, you develop a cough, and then you become short of breath as the pneumonia worsens.
So it obviously, that's the beginning in the first few days, but it's even though it primarily affects the lungs, can it cause infections in other parts of the body and therefore create wreck havoc?
Yes. So I think two things can happen. It can cause central nervous system involvement, and it can cause diarrhea, but also the body's immune response to the organism. There are many inflammatory chemicals that your body makes to fight the infection. They can damage other organs, so that can lead to what we call adult respiratory distress syndrome, which is where the lung gets damaged by these chemical mediators, but the kidneys can shut down, the liver can shut down, so any part of the body can shut down with this, and we call that multi-organ failure syndrome.
What about diagnosis and treatment? I mean, how do you know, now that you obviously have identified the bug, there's a way of approaching it, and you were saying you prophylactically you often do this broad spectrum approach, but you know, how is it actually diagnosed?
So one way to diagnose it is to do a urine antigen. So about 80%, there are many different types of Legionella, not just Legionella pneumoniae, but the majority of them, about 80% of them, can be identified by a urine test. So you collect a urine specimen, they look for some protein from the Legionella in your urine, and they can identify it in 80% of the cases. The other 20% of the cases you could miss that way. So that's not a 100% test. Another way you can do it is collect sputum or bronchoscopy specimens for culture. Think of Legionella. You have to tell the lab that you want them to do a special culture for Legionella because it requires special media. It won't grow on media that most bacteria grow on. And then a third way is by serology. So you have somebody who's ill. You collect a blood sample. You look at their serum for antibodies to the Legionella, and then you repeat the test 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, and if the titer of the antibodies went way up, that would tell you there was a recent infection.
But it sounds to me like treatment at this point
has to precede that. Yes.
Treatment occurs preceding any kind of diagnosis.
Yes, the cultures take 5 to 6 days, and usually the treatment's done by that period of time. So the important thing is to follow the Infectious Disease Society's guidelines and the American Thoracic Society's guidelines for community-acquired pneumonia. So if you follow those guidelines and treat them with the appropriate antibiotic that they recommend, you will cover Legionella as well as many other common causes of pneumonia.
So if you were to find a patient coming to this hospital or any other medical center and with a very severe form of pneumonia, you would automatically think the potential for Legionella.
Yes.
Based on all that you've said.
They would think of it in the emergency room even before somebody from my division would get to see the patient.
And are there ways to prevent it? In other words, you were talking about water systems.
Yeah, so
are there things in place to try to prevent it?
So here at Upstate, we check our water every month. The Infectious Control Committee and the engineering department keep an eye on this. Every month they do a culture of the water to look for Legionella. And they have a system, a chelating system, that treats the water, which will kill the organism.
But does it exist in the general public? Does it exist in some places more than others, for example, regions of this country?
So it's, for some reason, it's more common in western Pennsylvania and Michigan. There's a higher incidence of disease there. I'm not sure why that is. Maybe the water conditions are better there.
They have better water, and yet they're spreading Legionella. Well, that's very, very interesting. And basically today, then, the mortality rate has fallen, I would think, with this kind of aggressive treatment.
Yes.
So it is no longer, we needn't fear it the way we did when it first was diagnosed. Am I correct? That's correct. Well, I want to thank you for coming in. It's very, very enlightening information, helpful to understand. I mean, I think in the past, hearing that diagnosis was something somewhat frightening to people. Yeah. So good to know that we have a way of treating it these days successfully.
It's still serious, though.
It's still quite serious, yes. Well, thank you so very much. My guest has been Dr. Robert Lennox. He's professor of medicine emeritus and the past chief of the Division of Pulmonary Critical Care at Upstate Medical University. Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up. Excuses, or data, facts, evidence. Well, folks, even though I'm a psychologist who deals in happier, healthier, successier, we're going to have a physics lesson today. That's right. Sir Isaac Newton's first law of motion states, a body at rest will remain at rest unless an outside force acts on it. Now, the fact is our 21st century culture has systematically engineered all, quote, unnecessary motion out of our lives. As a result, a lot of us have bodies that are at rest almost all the time, and so much resting is getting us to the big rest, i.e. rest in peace, quicker and quicker. Now, we all know this. How come we're not doing something different? Well, because of Sir Rich O'Neill's first law of mental motion, i.e., a brain at rest tends to stay at rest unless acted on by an outside force. That is, unless a danger is immediate, our brains generate reasons, i.e. excuses, to do same old, i.e. as little as possible. For example, even though we know too much resting is killing us, a lot of us think, I've been sitting here for so long, there is no hope for me to get in shape any longer. And we stay put. So, how do we get our brains thinking differently so we can do something diff, i.e. get moving? Well, remember that outside force? The antidote to irrational excuses is an outside force of data, facts, evidence. Don't look now, but here they come. New research shows a doable, consistent, gradually increasing exercise program transformed roughly 30-year-old sit-around-all-the-time Janes and Joes into people with hearts like elite athletes, that's right, who accomplish dramatic exercise goals in a single year. They started off with 30 to 45 minutes of easy moving 3 to 4 times a week. You can do that. Brisk walking, jogging, bicycling, swimming. As they got fitter and had more energy, you'd like that, wouldn't you? They did more and increased the intensity to include intervals of hard exercise with rest periods. It's not too bad. Years end, not only did these folks have amazing hearts, but 10 of the 12 ran a marathon. One rode 100 miles on a bike, and the 12th did an Olympic-distance triathlon. Now, what if your brain is saying, but they were so much younger than me? Me too. Another study from about a year ago showed that just 6 months of regular walking, jogging, or biking, quote, restored the same level of aerobic capacity, end quote, that those 50-ish folks had 30 years earlier at 20. Imagine that. Want more good news? Sir Isaac Newton also says, a body in motion will remain in motion unless acted upon by an outside force. Sir Rich O'Neill's translation, once you get going, you'll keep on keeping on. I'm Dr. Rich. Do the diff, O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you.
Coming up next, does when you eat have a greater impact on your health than what you eat? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air, and it's time for your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of February 15th. Find peace with a pen. Situations and events that are distressing for many might not bother you in the least, or you may be sensitive to even minor stressors. The first step in managing stress is to identify your triggers. Knowing when, where, and why stress occurs, along with your stress symptoms and how you cope, can help you reduce exposure or come up with successful strategies to alleviate this issue. This week, start a stress journal. At week's end, reread your entries to identify common themes to your stress, and then you can brainstorm some solutions. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Well, mothers have long suspected that midnight snacking is bad for you. But until recently, there was little scientific evidence to support that suspicion. Well, now a new study has shed some light on this topic with some important evidence that could impact our health. Here with more on this is Maureen Franklin, a registered dietitian nutritionist at Upstate Medical University's community campus. Welcome, Maureen. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So it's not only what you eat, but when you eat it that counts, this study seems to show. Tell us about that, and what's the background? What was this study trying to do?
The study was trying to look at more in terms of getting a specific amount of caloric intake and then looking at time frame. One study, the previous study that was mentioned in this, was an 8-hour window frame that they looked at the mice in terms of how long did they eat, what did they eat. They controlled what they ate, but they found that it was the time frame. So this next study went into it a little bit more in depth, found in terms of fed mice different high caloric, high fat, different things, but controlled the calories, but looked at the time frame, a 9 to 12 hour window frame.
So let's back up for just a minute. So the first study that led to this now recently published study was in 2012.
Correct.
And they were looking at, they discovered that even the mice who ate a high fat diet, if they could eat whenever they wanted, they gained weight and became morbidly obese and developed diabetes.
Correct.
If they were limited to a certain time frame, as you mentioned, the 8-hour window, they didn't seem to have the same symptoms, even though they ate the same calories, and neither group exercised.
Right.
So this new study, which I thought was fascinating, of course it's only on mice, it appeared in the Journal of Cell Metabolism. They looked at four groups with four different diets.
Right.
There was a high-fat, high-fructose, high-fat, high-fructose, high-fat, and high-fructose, and then regular what they called mouse kibble, which I guess is much less high-fat.
Mm-hmm.
And even though they all ate the same thing, they were restricted to the feeding time that we talked about.
Right.
And so, repeat again. So what did they actually find? Which mice ended up worse off?
The mice that had no time frame, that were able to eat whenever, however long that they wanted, they gained weight, all right? And the mice that were restricted in terms of the time from that 9 to 12-hour window, they actually didn't gain weight. And when they reversed it and took actually an interesting part of this, which I thought was fascinating, they took mice who had been in the study who had no time frame, put them back into a time frame, and they actually lost weight. Which to me is so fascinating, because to me it's, we're looking at a controlled caloric intake, which usually when we talk about weight gain and time frames and sleep, we usually relate it to no limit on time, but also tendency towards high caloric intake.
So we would always, when we think about weight gain, just to rephrase that, when we've thought about weight gain, it's always been about calorie intake,
mm-hmm.
whether there's exercise,
correct.
And what type of foods we're eating.
Correct.
And this really throws a monkey wrench into that whole thing.
Total monkey wrench.
Yeah, because it suggests that whatever you eat, and whether you exercise or not,
right,
is almost irrelevant. And I mean, granted, this is a mouse study,
right?
But the idea being that the times you choose to eat, or the amount of time that you are engaged in the quote unquote eating experience,
right? Yes, that time frame seems to be the interesting part of this study. I feel in terms of that. I could work with clients and say, okay, you need to now look at when you start to eat and when you end your eating, all right? And this can relate it to people who work shift or students that are up late. You start your day at a class at 8 o'clock, but then you're studying till 1. Are you eating from 8 to 1 o'clock at night?
A.M., you mean.
A.M., yeah. Yes. And are you eating, and is that past this 9 to 12-hour window that this study is looking for? So, yes, it's only been in mice, but It's a very interesting study, I think, in terms of, is it time? Is it metabolism? Is it sleep? There's so many questions on this, but I think it could open up a whole new realm of studies.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with nutritionist and registered dietitian Maureen Franklin. We're talking about a new study that suggests it's not what you eat, but when you eat, that actually affects weight gain and health. Let me go back to the conclusions for the mice, okay, just to review it. So the mice that were prevented from eating at all hours avoided both obesity and the metabolic problems that come with it,
mm-hmm.
even if their diet was sometimes unhealthful.
Correct.
And that yet the time-restricted eating didn't just prevent, but also, and as you mentioned, reversed the
yes.
obesity.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing was that I thought was really shocking was that the mice that consumed the regular kibble, which was the lesser fat food, in fixed time frames also had less body fat than those that ate the same kibble
whenever
they chose.
Yes.
So I guess let me go back to with some of your, you mentioned very briefly some of these hypotheses as to why this could happen. They seem to suggest that the time at which food is eaten influences the body's internal clock. Well, what does that mean, and how does that then affect weight gain?
Well, that's the interesting thing of this study. I think they're looking at is it not just caloric intake, but it's in terms of your own body rhythm. And if we are extending our time frame of eating, are we interrupting our body rhythm? And to me, when I looked at this, I was looking at, does that mean that the people who were eating longer, we're getting less sleep, and we're looking at so many more studies about the relationship between good sleep habits, good hours of sleep, and potential weight gain.
So you're suggesting from research that you've looked at, not this study,
but no.
other things you found in your role, is that sleep deprivation or lack of sleep will contribute to weight gain. And so you thought that could possibly be the link here.
That's when I looked at this, I'm thinking, wow, this is really interesting. That was one of my thoughts. The other thought is it affect our hormonal imbalance? Is it affecting our metabolism? Is the body really want to go to sleep, but we're making it stay up later and we're feeding it? And is that actually a detriment to our body? And that's kind of what it looks like in terms of this study, is what I got thinking about. But there's so many interconnections here. It could be, is it insulin? Is it your metabolic syndrome? Is it your sleep pattern? And are all these intricately related to potential weight gain?
Mm-hmm. Well, the study, the members of the study suggested that the meal times have an effect on what we call the rhythm. You talked to body
right.
rhythm. The term is called circadian rhythm. And they said that even more than dark and light, I mean, we know that our sleep patterns are affected by how much light there is
mm-hmm.
and how much darkness there is.
Right.
And they said the circadian rhythm, which is now they feel affected more by when you're eating than the dark and light cycles, actually affects the function of the genes in the body and therefore metabolism.
Right.
So that in some way this idea, just as you said, of keeping yourself active when
mm-hmm.
you should really be at rest
is it
might be playing a big role. So bottom line here, as you were alluding to, this is going to have, this could have, obviously a lot more research has to be done, but this could have a real impact on what you might advise people down the road if more studies support this notion, especially when you talk about students or people, for example, what about people who work night shift people. Or late shift, mm-hmm. and their whole rhythm is off or different than would be a quote-unquote standard work day.
And I think that's an important thing, because normally when I would counsel someone, I would have them, and anyone, even if you're into looking at weight, everyone just looks at the caloric intake. How many calories am I taking? When am I doing it? What am I eating? How much fat? But now this would be a whole new realm of looking at in terms of, when do you start? When do you end? What is your time frame? What's your window? Is the study did that 9 to 12-hour window. What's your window of eating? Are you eating into a 14-hour span, a 16-hour span? And then you expect, oh, I should be losing weight. So to me, there's so many more things that they could be studying in here, but I think it's fascinating, and it could change how we counsel patients in terms of, I still think probably caloric intake is definitely, I think it's important because, again, I think there's metabolism, all those things that are interrelated, but I think this is interesting to look at what's happening with your time. And we talk about that sometimes with clients, like, do you have a regular pattern of what you eat? And I find sometimes when people don't have a pattern
as to when they eat.
As to when they eat, and not that they need to eat, you know, at 12 o'clock on the dot, but I find a lot of times when people have an irregular eating schedule, I do see that they have a tendency to gain weight. So in my own practice, it really helps me think, oh, I might have been on track with something in terms of it. Because a lot of times when people say, well, I eat breakfast, whenever. And if you work on a regular...
Or grab it when you can.
That's right. And now it's just saying, well, maybe we need to help people work on more of a planned or regular schedule within time frames and time limits.
Do you think that there's something to this idea, though, of the 3 meal a day concept, or that it's not just the 8-hour window or the 9 to 12-hour window of eating, but also that you eat at regular intervals rather than, as some people have said, it's okay to eat small, frequent meals throughout the day?
I think either way could work, but I think you still need some time frame. You still need a timeline. If you're like, okay, I like snacks and I want to eat small little mini meals, that's great, but there needs to be a time frame for that. If you just had breakfast at 8 o'clock, you probably don't need a snack at 9:15. But if your lunch isn't until 2, okay, an 11:30. So I don't necessarily want people to think that I can only have 3 meals or I can't have snacks. I think we need to look at everybody's pattern. I think that's important. But you do need, I think, to establish a pattern as some time frame. When am I eating? When am I having these snacks? Not to have it like a free-for-all in terms of it. And that's kind of what this is kind of giving me the idea. The calories were controlled. The time was controlled. So there had to be some type of, not set schedule, but I bet there was some element to it in terms of it. And that's why I think it's interesting.
One of their takeaways, I think, that they said, which I think you're alluding to or really kind of reinforcing, is that if you can contain your eating to roughly 10 hours a day, 12 hours a day or less, in other words, the time in which you eat is within a 12-hour time frame or less, then you're ahead of the game, as opposed to extending it toward any hours of the day and
any extra hours
that you might be up. You know, it's that idea of waking up in the middle of the night and going and raiding
getting
the refrigerator.
Snack. Yeah. Or it could be even just think of the basics of it. If you get up at 7 and you have a breakfast at 7:30, but you have a very late day and you're coming home and you're eating dinner at 8:30, 9 o'clock, that really relates to this time frame that we're talking about. And people are like, well, I still ate the same amount of calories. Yes, but if you ate it at 9 or 9:30, maybe this is where it could possibly have an effect.
Well, very interesting, something really to be thinking about. And I appreciate your coming in and helping explain this study. It's something definitely, in this case, food for thought. Thank you so much for coming in. My guest has been Maureen Franklin. She's a registered dietitian nutritionist at Upstate Medical University's community campus. I'm Linda Cohen. And you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. I love it when a writer recasts a familiar object in a new light. Healthcare professionals are very knowledgeable about the MRI scanners they use on a daily basis. But listen to how Dana Curtis, poet and editor of Elixir Press, describes her time in one. Her poem is called Resonance, and she explores the fear and awe such a machine inspires. I took the tunnel into the magnet and found myself surrounded by some new music, atonal, minimalist. The loud percussion echoed by small clicks and distant strings, not so much melodic as insistent, punctuated by short, significant silences, then weird blats of horns, appropriate in this context. This is the symphony meant to force the disease to reveal all its stratagems and secret methods. While I remember a small room where I listened to a John Cage piece performed on sticks, and climbing over the rocks to the amphitheater where I spent more time watching the stars than listening to the musicians. The conductor was an old friend and led me to a tunnel through the mountains. I stood still in the crescendo, in this machine, this revelation.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Please join us again next week when we look at high blood pressure and heart disease in women. Plus, we'll explore polycystic ovarian syndrome and how to treat it. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's healthlinkonair.org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can look for us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink On Air is directed by Amber Smith and Jennifer Conjol and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.